instead of the gun being power, now it's this notion of knowledge and arcane knowledge. And we see what's happened in this world, in fact, is that the old European empires are falling behind, right? Because they don't, for the most part, they don't have access to this.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
Live from the offices of the Ministry of Alchemy, Enchantments, and Supernatural Entities.
Yay, I'm Sean.
I'm Brandon.
And on today's show, we are joined once more by P. Jelly Clark to talk about his latest book, A Master of Djinn. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Sean and Brandon. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here.
We're going to have so many questions.
Before we do that, a friendly reminder that we want to hear from you. So share your comments with us about this and past episodes at skiffyandfanti.com/listener suggestions. We want to put together a listener mailbag episode with your thoughts, questions, topic suggestions, and more. So we'd like to hear from you.
And also a special thanks to our newest Patreon supporter, who is Darren the Daring. You know who you are. Appreciate you. Thanks so much for the support.
So to the main event then. Fenderson,
yes.
What is A Master of Djinn about?
I don't have my elevator pitch ready. The Master of Djinn is the return to the world that I started in 2016 with the publication of my short story, A Dead Djinn in Cairo. It returns us to ancient Fatma and the ministry, and it is set in an alternate Cairo, an alternate Egypt, 1912, of steampunk and djinn. And basically what this is that there is someone who is claiming to be a very famous figure central to this world who has returned. And hilarity and hijinks ensue. Including
some stabbing and burning
death. Yes, yes. There's a little bit of that as well.
So there's lots to talk about with this book. It's a lot of fun. And I'm glad to see that you're coming back to the world, because obviously you'd mentioned you'd done a short story with this particular character, but then you also had The Haunting of Tramcar 15, which was set in the same world, but with different characters, as I recall. And so I guess the big question for me would be to talk about the challenge of basically going back to this world, but also doing it on novel length, because we've got short story to novella, and now you've got 380-something page book. What was the challenge?
Perfect, right? I did very theological, just started, and I just worked my way up. And I had this all planned, of course, not. As I think I've said this before to people, when I wrote A Dead Djinn in Cairo, I had no inkling that there would be more in that done to do in that world. I wrote that story simply as almost a one-off. I didn't know if it would get published. It was by chance that I sent out a Facebook post asking if anybody was interested, and Diana Foe at Tor said, sure, let me see it. Next thing you know, it's published. So complete random acts of chance there. And then after that, I didn't know there would be more until people were asking, is there going to be more? So I said, I guess I better come up with something. So about a year later, I sat down and I sketched out really a timeline of the world to give me a setting. Because I'd left doors open. I'd left a lot of places to go. And there was a lot to do there. And so once I had that, I decided, let me taste this and take it out for a spin. And so I wrote The Haunting of Tramcar 015. That was like my test to see if this world could do more. And it was a lighthearted story for the most part, though it really allowed, it was a lot of exploring the world and giving little bits and pieces. Turns out people like that one too. Big surprise that people were just interested in a story about, transport systems and Armenian candy. But you never know what appeals to folks. And so when that was done, it just seemed the next logical step was the novel. And even then, I still had not thought of what I wanted to do for a novel. And so I simply had to sit down and think, like, okay. It was like a year later. So this is all probably 2016, 2017, 2018, I'm writing the novel. I settled on going back to Fatma because she was the character everyone had liked. She makes a cameo in The Haunting of Tramcar 015. And so I knew it. I had to return to her. And so this was a story that came up. I think it took me about maybe a week to come up with the idea because I had nothing. I have no idea what to do. What am I gonna, like, a whole novel? What's gonna keep hold of people's interest? And you know, when you're writing, once the story takes hold and I knew what it was, I just had to think about it for a while. I think I took about a week of just imagining, you know, while I'm doing random things in the shower, like, oh yeah, maybe that. Mowing the lawn, oh yeah, maybe that. And once I had the idea, it was just a matter of writing the book. The easy part.
Oh, yeah, it's totally easy.
Of course. It's never been easier, I'm sure.
I love this image of you just, like, you're trying to mow the lawn and you're, like, paused in the middle of the lawn because you have a thought. Just...
Literally, that's what happened. That's literally it. And thank goodness, you know, our phones now, I can go to notes and I can just jot down something really quickly. Or, you know, for something that's really meaty, I just chew on it for a long time and I don't even have to jot it down because I'm not going to forget because I really want this. And so I think it just took a while for that to happen. And then once I figured it was in my head, I could sit down and sketch out an outline because I'm not a pantser. I don't do that. So I need to have an outline. I need to have a beginning and ending or it's not going to work.
Fair enough.
Regardless, outline that I created, there were a lot of changes to the story as I was writing. As the story began, you know, like stories do, telling itself, deciding to go in ways that I had not anticipated.
So one of the questions that I definitely have, because this is a thing that comes up often when I talk about your work, you know for a fact I'm a big fan of your work. One of the things that is very standout about your work is that you have an academic background in history that definitely plays a part in the stories that you tell, because it's very noticeable in A Master of Djinn, but in your previous work, that you like to play with the relationships of power between communities of color and communities of empire. And the way that that stands out in A Master of Djinn is the relationship between Egypt and the United Kingdom. And I'm very curious, was that a very deliberate response to colonialism? And what kind of compels you about the period that you describe in this work that you can talk more about in terms of that kind of historical?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is yes to all of that. You know, this story, the very idea of this world came about while I was an adjunct professor before I had my PhD. And I was adjuncting and I was teaching classes on world history. And I would have entire sections. And it was, I think, 1500 to modern day. So a lot of history. And it was global. But, you know, the big chunk of it would be about colonialism once we entered the modern era. And so, you know, it was between exploring ideas of Orientalism and Edward Said's Orientalism with students and talking about colonialism and anti-colonial movements. And I'd actually show the Battle of Algiers and we'd talk about some C.L.R. James, you know, talking about colonialism even in the 1930s by talking about the Haitian Revolution as predicting what the anti-colonial movement would be about and then going into the post-colonial. Somewhere in all of that, the idea of this world took shape. Right? It was this what if, as we tend to love to do in fantasies or even in history, this counterfactual. My students love counterfactuals. Like, what if this had happened? And I think some of that rubbed off on me. And I started thinking, well, how would I subvert colonialism? What would subvert it? What causes colonialism? I started thinking of the Industrial Revolution, the ability of these European empires, these Western European empires now with armed with new types of guns, armed with medicine to, you know, thwart malaria in Africa, armed with the Maxim gun. This, you know, the Maxim gun is literally the conqueror of Africa. It's literally, when it's first created, one of the reasons its creator makes it, the precursor to the machine gun, is they say it's here to scare the natives, right? To give them a psychic shock because of the power of what it could do. And when you read people who survived the Maxim guns. On the other side of it, they tell you, you know, it was psychologically damaging. Here they think, we'll just go and fight these invaders. But, you know, we hear bap, bap, bap. I remember one person saying, and we looked around and everyone was dead, right? It was just this understanding of the firepower and how this changed the world in the late 19th to early 20th century. It changed the power dynamics of the world. And so that's my serious part in between all this. And so I was like, I want to tell a story that's kind of about this and it has those themes of anti-colonialism, but I want to do it with magic and a bowler and to kind of bury it between all these layers of an interesting story, right? But that was definitely the influence for this. And when I came about thinking of, well, what's going to thwart the Maxing Gun and the power of Empire, I was like, oh, how about magic? That's how this world in some ways was born. And then after that, it was the stories were born. And, you know, that I think I've kept that theme throughout. And if I think I hinted at it in the first, in the short story, I definitely push it a bit more in The Haunting of Tramp Car 015 as far as the background. I think in this one, it's almost front and center, right? This one, the world is fully fleshed out. And that's the great thing about a novel. I could go in places I couldn't go before. But certainly, yes, it's about those interactions of power and thinking about what does a post-colonial world look like, right? What does that world look like if it never happens? In this case, within Egypt, it's not a utopia. They still have to deal with a lot of their own issues. They just don't have that external interference any longer.
Yeah, this all really interested me, you know, coming from a different angle, because, you know, I was reading this and realizing there's not a lot that I know about Egypt, except like very broad strokes, which I think is a thing a lot of people kind of know about Egypt. Like they had pharaohs once and like the British occupied them, you know, and then the Ottoman Empire got kind of involved. Like, but beyond that, they don't necessarily get to all the gritty details. But one of the things I thought was really interesting as you were exploring this were like the dynamics of race and how complicated that is. So you've got this figure of Dalton at the very beginning of the book, so we're not spoiling a lot, who literally believes that this figure, Al-Jahiz, who is this sort of like mythical figure in Egypt, could not have been a black man, right? A Sudanese man. Impossible, because all the ancient Egyptians, he claims, are like more like the white Europeans. And of course, this goes horribly for him at the very beginning of the book. Very badly. I really enjoyed the exploration of the sort of racial dynamics in this world, because you're right, like it's not a utopia. There are still a lot of these problems, but you kind of get to this idea, I think, in the book of the very like transnational nature of racism, that these ideas translate across different places. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about, you know, exploring that dynamic, not in this world, and seeing how it kind of fit into all these little pieces.
Yeah, no, it's funny. The part, again, this is my way of, I do a lot of wink and nods in here, right? And anyone who's familiar with early race science and the measuring of skulls and early, unfortunately, where early anthropology used to be before Frank Boas kind of pulled them out of the quote unquote dark ages, right, where they used to be. This was a lot of it. This was a lot of trying to look at parts of the ancient world and figure out often how do they relate to Europe, right? And we will, in some ways, Europhy everybody we'd like, right? So there's a point where even Nubians at one point among some are like, well, aren't they actually dark whites who are actually, right? And there's this constant notion of race is constantly plays its role in here, where it's hard to even look at these cultures in the West without constantly bringing in this lens of race, right? And Egypt is one of these places where, you know, this constantly occurs through the Western lens, and as far as much of the East in many ways. And so I was playing around with that. Dalton, yes, he's a stand-in for many people whose names I won't mention. Some early quote-unquote explorers, as well as early writers on race and race science and so forth, who have these notions, right? He believes in craniometrics and the skull, and that he can look at someone and tell who they are. And it's this nonsense, right? That it's a pseudoscience, but he's bringing it to bear here. And unfortunately, this was much of this. You found this in many early explorers and quote-unquote scholars of this region. And so that was one thing I want to bring in. But then I also bring in other things. I mean, I won't give it away. This is not a big thing to give away, but I have some Americans who happen to be here, right? Some people from New Orleans, right? Who happen to be here, you know, and they say there's no Jim Crow in Cairo, right? Because they're fleeing Jim Crow in the United States. And that's a nod to much of the Black diaspora who in places like the United States went somewhere else, right? Searching for, like often emigrated to other places, searching for if things are better. And that's from our, so a lot of this is plucked from our real history. At the same time, I also talk about issues of race and colorism within Egyptian society itself, right? That also exists. And you see, for instance, I get to tell that story somewhat with these Black Americans who are thankful there's not, you know, Jim Crow in Cairo. But then one of them says, well, I've seen some things that are, that seem systemic and problematic, right? And so it's this complication. And it's something that Fatma herself, I think I've hit it since the beginning, that, you know, she deals with being darker skinned. So it's something about issues of colorism that permeate societies, part of our issues of race. It's kind of all in there, but it's complex. So, you know, I don't try to beat it over the head, but I do insert it within here because I think it would be unrealistic to say that it doesn't exist, right? These are going to be problems that exist.
Mm-hmm. It definitely comes across as less like this story is absolutely about these things,
yeah,
but more as this is the world. Like, this, yeah, is stuff that happens in the real world. Real.
Yeah.
But you're making me think a lot of, you know, this brief movement in the Caribbean where people were thinking that they'd go under the rule of Simón Bolívar, because the belief was that, oh, well, he had freed all the slaves, and so there was no slavery. That wasn't actually true.
Right.
But there was this effort to get people to leave some of the colonies in the Caribbean to go there for that precise reason, not realizing that in a lot of cases you were just going to a different version of the same situation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the tactics and strategies might be different. And you saw this especially with a lot of Black immigrationists who would go to different places, and, you know, they'd go to Paris. Some of them went to the Soviet Union. They'd go to different places and, you know, they would say, look, I find breathing room here. But then after a while, they would say, okay, I didn't say it didn't. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's just different.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like, so how do we adapt to this difference? Yeah.
Like, I'm also thinking, like, the repatriation movement as well, when folks like Marcus Garvey were, like, insisting, yeah, that we would find not only a place, but our place by returning to...
In the continent, right? We would go to Africa and we would make a type of utopia.
Yeah.
Those are also dreams. Those are dreams, yeah, in the diaspora, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And I like that kind of discussion of... Maybe there is like some kind of solution that you get from the problem that you left by arriving here, but it doesn't mean that those problems don't exist.
Yeah.
And you still have to talk about them.
Right, exactly. So in this case, even over on the larger picture, yes, Britain has been removed from the equation. Egypt has its independence, but it still has to deal with all the interpersonal issues that are part of humanity, right? It still has to deal with issues of gender, with issues of sexuality. It still has to deal with issues of modernity and race and color. All those things are still there. All that happens now is they have the self-determination to deal with it on their own without worrying about, you know, what the external influences that are going to come in and, you know, push things around. Yeah. I didn't create a perfect world. Sorry, folks.
So I have an interesting question, coming back to like the ways in which history play a role in your storytelling. One of the things that I think is kind of interesting, at least the way that I read a lot of these stories that are being told in Fatma's world, there is this very interesting kind of softly played implication that a great deal of the power that exists in this space is a matter of knowledge rather than force. That it's not, yeah, about who has the biggest gun, but it's about the fact that there is this vast wealth of mystical knowledge that is being unlocked and deeply understood in this space. I think that's a really interesting interplay when having these kinds of deep, thoughtful conversations about race and history, because a lot of the history of race in these spaces has always been won by the gun, where there is this kind of insinuation that there is an increased kind of power by simply being given access to knowledge, being given access to what is fundamentally a kind of academic knowledge, but also very arcane. And I think that that's very interesting as well.
Yeah, no, that's a key part of it. I'm glad you touched on that, right? That's so much of it is based on that. I wrote a blog post a while back about the power of the gun in steampunk, right? Because steampunk is so wrapped around the gun. And I'm not knocking this, by the way. I think steampunk guns look cool and inventive. But there is an obsession that steampunkers have with guns, right? And I've always thought it's ironic that it comes about during the same era where we're seeing where the gun is basically now the conqueror of all of these places, these new weapons and all of this. And I said, you know, have we thought about in steampunk our love of the gun and our relationship to it and what that means overall, especially since steampunk, we know, has long faced criticisms of ignoring issues of colonialism and imperial and empire and all else, right? And so these are all these things I kind of wanted to unlock in here. And it again goes to this thing is like what thwarts this, I think you said it perfectly, Brandon, that instead of the gun being power, now it's this notion of knowledge and arcane knowledge. And we see what's happened in this world, in fact, is that the old European empires are falling behind. Right? Because they don't, for the most part, they don't have access to this. And, you know, they're kind of getting annoyed and watching others, you know, kind of move forward because they're rediscovering, quote unquote, this old arcane knowledge, and they are able to rise forward. And so we have places like Egypt where the Djinn are using their knowledge and power. And I think somebody had asked me once, well, why don't the Djinn just take over? Right? Why didn't they just come and take over? In some ways, they don't have to. They have the knowledge. They have these understandings. And it's like the squabbles among mortals almost seem petty mm-hmm. at times, right? Compared to, yes, at any time, they have power enough to neutralize all of that, right? And so it doesn't bother them. But we are seeing, that's a good point you're making. We're seeing this shift in dynamic about what is power in this world. And it's going to cause conflict, or it is causing conflict.
And the thing that I admire about that is that because you place that knowledge in the hands of black characters, you're also not only like having a very sly conversation about the ways in which black knowledge is valued and understood in the world as it is, but they get to be agents of their own and get to act in powerful and dramatic ways, but those yeah. ways aren't always immediately violent, even though they're not averse to violence as well.
Yeah, they get, yeah, exactly. They, and this is something that I think, you know, somebody who, when you're looking at colonialism, is always the what if, it's almost like the dream. Well, what would allow for agency and, you know, for the colonized to be self-sufficient and have the power to forge their own destinies, right? And this is what I've come up with. It's fantastical, but it's an exercise in thinking about how things may be different, right, at the end of the day. But yeah.
If we could take a journey down into the magical, sure. Because naturally, djinn are important in the story. You know, if the title didn't give it away, they're kind of significant.
Yeah.
And I love the variety of djinn that you have in here. You've got everything from like library djinn to like very old school kind of djinn who are like humans are basically ants and I'm waiting for you all to die out, to djinn who are maybe on the more friendly side, to very sarcastic, to basically all different types. There's just tons of different djinn. And I was curious because obviously you've had djinn in some of the previous works, but here you just get a lot more space to play around with them as characters, as people. You know, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way that you were positioning djinn as, you kind of bounce off Brandon's question, as in some cases purveyors of this power of knowledge. Because yes, they are magical, but they also are often very much embedded in the acquisition and, you know, if you could say collection and power associated with knowledge.
Yeah, and so that's a great question. I mean, you know, my visual cues on the djinn came from my own time looking through old manuscripts, from medieval manuscripts to even manuscripts from the early modern era, from Persia, from Mughal Empire, right? I in fact have one picture I tend to keep around of these djinn that are pretty much like these djinn from the Mughal Empire, from their manuscripts that really inspire it. And what you see are all these different shapes. And then sometimes djinn are also known to take the shapes of animals, cats, and other things. And so there's a lot to work with there in the understanding of how djinn are discussed. And djinn are also part of these various cultures that, you know, span vast areas. There are ideas of djinn throughout much of the Muslim world, and even has spread to parts of the non-Muslim world, right? So there are ideas of djinn in Coptic Christian areas in the Horn of Africa. There are ideas of djinn in the Maghreb. There are ideas of djinn as far as Morocco, but also in Persia, as well as what we quote-unquote called Middle East, right? And further on, ideas of Zen in India with me, which may merge with some local ideas. And so there's so many different ways that Zen can be interpreted and so many different stories of how Zen are. It was easy to see Zen as very diverse. Like, there's not one thing like we have in the West, the notion of the genie is always blue and he comes out the bottle and he has the three wishes. No, Zen are, they're supposed to be, they're a half Zen, and there are all kinds of, I mean, there are so many within the various stories of how Zen are discussed that there was just a lot to play with there. And so I thought of it almost like a first contact story where, you know, Zhen are always there, but they're now corporeal. They're now everyone can see them. They're not hidden as before. And so, I've tried to imagine, well, what's that like? How do human beings who in these cultures, they believe in Zhen already, right? It's not as if they didn't believe in Zhen. They believe that Zhen are part of their world. They're just often unseen. But what happens if they become seen? What happens if they become fully corporeal and they're sitting at your table, right? And they are now part of society. Do you give them citizenship? What happens now, right? How are we supposed to view them? They say they can work. Well, okay, they can work now, so they get contracts. What kind of jobs would they have? You know, what can they do perhaps better than mortal? What can people do better? And all of this, I started thinking of how do we integrate them into society? Even at the same time, while, as you said, they're people, they're also not, right? They also, the way their minds work, the way they view things are still going to be very different than how people view things. And right, and so it's this way where humanity is now questioning, what does it mean to be human if there are these other beings who, as you point out, have all this power, have all this knowledge, and don't think exactly like we do all the time, right? Don't have the exact human ways of thinking. How do we live in that world? And this is where someone like Fatma, she's uniquely placed to kind of bridge both of these, right? She's like, I'm here to, that's what the ministry is here for, to make certain that this world doesn't unravel because it becomes too much for people to bear, that this world finds a way to coexist. That's kind of the meat of the story in many ways in this world building.
I love that one of the things that you had in here as your way of saying, like, what would a world with Zhen, like, what would Zhen do is Zhen happen to be really good lawyers.
Yeah, of course.
Because they're very particular about the language.
Yeah, contract. They're into contract law. Yeah, don't try to swindle Zhen.
Do not, yeah, that's a big thing. In fact, there's a moment in the story when she doesn't swindle him, but Fatma basically is very clever with a Zhen and uses very particular language and kind of gets him to agree to something that he didn't technically want to, but because she was clever with the language, of course, he gets her back.
Yeah, he gets her back, right? He's like, look, and it's this idea like, we've been doing this for a few centuries. Come on.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like, it puts this joke to the Zhen who's like, oh, you're forced, I'm forced to grant you three wishes. You know, it's like, come on. I know how to actually do this to my benefit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like the thing about Zhen is all Zhen think that they're much more cleverer than people. They're certain about that.
Even when they're not.
Yeah, even when they're not, they are absolutely certain that they are cleverer than mortals.
All of that like thrives off of some of the things that we already admire the most about other subgenres like urban fantasy, where we like to see bureaucracy play out in very complicated and interesting ways, but we're doing it with essentially surreal bureaucrats, and like Fatma's like station as a result is we get to see the story play out as if it were a hard-boiled detective story or a spy novel, but it's also at times very comedic and like very dramatic in the way that it thinks about the way that we engage with each other politically, which is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, because you have to think about it, two things. One, our world can be absurd at times. You ever like had to fill out so many documents, you're like, why am I doing this? So, like, I remember the MC, Yasin Bey, people know as Mos Def, used to have a song called, I think it was like, Why, right? And it was like, if I have ID, why do I need ID, right, to get ID? If I had ID, I wouldn't need, you know, he talks about these absurd ways of bureaucracy can at times work. And so I think I'm channeling some of my old Douglas Adams, right? I thought he was great at like showing like bureaucracy, it can be ridiculous. Yet bureaucracy is important, right? As much as people hate bureaucracy. If you don't have it, your society starts kind of falling apart, right? You need regulations. You need these forms. You need these things. And so it's always this balance between the two. But, you know, I figure you add in elements of the magic and everything else, and where magic, as we think about it, is often very formulaic, right? It's very prescriptive. You have to do this, this, or this to get this. The apprentice doesn't do this one little thing, the demon is summoned and gobbles them up, right? We know this from all of our genre. And so I just think it was great to play along with these notions. There are these strict laws that have to be governed almost like by a script. And if you don't follow these laws, right, that things can go wrong. And I think I do this. I play this especially with the so-called angels, right, who, of course, extremely bureaucratic.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question again about those kinds of like subgenre interplays, because as I said, it does play out very much like a hard-boiled detective novel, which exists in the kind of space where readers expect not only to be surprised by a random turn of events, but to arrive at the end where all of the pieces that they thought didn't fit perfectly suddenly fit. And to have that nestled so neatly within a fantasy story where often a great deal of the rules are not necessarily disconnected from each other or don't have their own like interesting interplays, but are built in ways to surprise us and intrigue us in ways that often those things don't very neatly mesh. And I'm kind of curious what the experience was trying to write a story that does both, and like how do you feel about the result?
I am fascinated by people who can do that, where like I reach the end and I'm like the meme of the guy from the Wire meme, where the guy's like, you know, that meme, like, I'm fascinated, like, when people do that, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's like, you're standing right there, Tyler Durden. I'm amazed when people can do that kind of stuff, right? You know, when they can simply Kaiser Soze me into real, like, what? And so, you know, I don't know that I can fully pull that off in a real world. But in the fantasy world, where I can bend reality, there are all kinds of ways, because at the end of the day, it's always a sleight of hand, right? It's always a magic trick. You're trying to throw all these other things at people so they don't notice that you've done this other thing with your hand. And so the great thing about fantasy is that, you know, while all of the mystery is happening, you've got so-called angels, you've got jinn, you've got a free, you can have all of these other things going on to kind of bury the mystery. So like, even if people kind of have an idea of the mystery, you can throw them off at one point because you can do something magical. They're like, wait a minute, that's not, because everybody's still thinking logically. Right? Mm-hmm. We think of mysteries logically. We're not thinking, oh, there's going to be some magical thing that upends it. And so I think it's always fun to do that. And, you know, I think with mine, I think a lot of people probably arrive at what they think the mystery might be, but I still give them, even if they arrive and they say, aha, I knew it, I want them to be a happy, like, yes, I knew it, right? Not like, psh, I knew it, but more so like, yeah, this is what I wanted, and there's more, mm-hmm. right? In a normal mystery, it ends, and it's like, who did it? It was, you know, Mr. Plumber, and he did it, and we just end. But it's like, it's kind of like, have you ever seen the movie Clue? Like, they had three different versions of how it could end. One of the great things you can do in fantasy is, like, figuring out the mystery is just the beginning. Like, when I write the story, that's just the beginning of the end. Like, there's nothing better than figuring out the mystery than looking at the book and saying, oh, wow, there are a lot of pages to still go. Right? Most mysteries, they just end and it's done. Good job, Mr. Holmes, you know, and that's over. But in doing a fantasy, since it's partly that, but it's also a fantasy novel, that solving the mystery, like I said, is just the beginning. There's often a lot more to happen. And in this case, you know, I hope that people get that as well.
I definitely got that. I got that exciting moment of like, aha, I kind of do it. And then I was like, but there's more.
Yeah, a lot more. Yeah.
There's a lot more. It's like, oh, maybe the book isn't just about just this thing. There's more going on.
A lot more going on.
Yeah, I do like that one of your mysteries is this, the figure of the imposter, Al-Jahiz, who, and I will say with quotation marks, the imposter, because everybody assumes that he's an imposter, but he claims himself very much, I am Al-Jahiz. And what I find super interesting about him is that in setting up this figure, you've placed him as this figure that's not so easily dismissed, that he is very powerful,
yeah.
that he speaks with an enormous amount of authority. He speaks in a lot of ways like the person that he is. And so there is this element kind of as you go through the book of who is this guy really? Is he actually the person
yeah.
who would be like 100 something years old?
Yeah.
But it's a world with magic. He could be.
Possible, right? Yeah, even Fatma has to say like, I don't know. You know what's going on, yeah. And, you know, he can do some amazing things, right? And so, yeah, it was funny when I was trying to figure out an idea to come up with this. Somehow I knew that I had to tackle the issue of Al-Jahiz because he's so central to this. He's always mentioned, and he's central to everything that happened, right? He's why this world exists. And so it was great to go back and touch on that. And this character, it's great to have this villainous character who is actually, he's pulling at some of the problematic threads of this Egypt, right? Like he wouldn't be able to amass a following, right? If there weren't these problems, right? He knows where these problems are. He knows where the fault lines are, right? And it's something that I think like characters like Hadiya, she recognizes right away, right? Perhaps even more than Fatma, like, this is what's happening here. This is like, we have problems and he's just exploiting them at the end of the day. But he's also throwing around conspiracy theories and everything else, which I just, you know, I couldn't help but it just fit our day. He is a disinformation campaign, right? Where he pulls on people's real anxieties and feeds them disinformation, right? And this is how he is able to do what he does in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Which is very striking in its own way in the year of our Lord 2021.
He is the modern internet.
Yeah. There is a kind of bravery in deciding to present an antagonist in a story who is doing that, but simultaneously genuinely doing what other people consider speaking truth to power in a way that is not necessarily wrong or untrue.
It's like those kinds of people are always the best because you're not certain where they stand. It doesn't mean that what they're saying doesn't have a bit of truth to it. They simply may be doing it for their own reasons.
Yeah. Like, I think of Killmonger in Black Panther,
who
is not wrong.
Like, the question is Killmonger a hero or not? And it's like, no, he's not.
Yeah.
He's not the first person to use that language. He'll be a very terrible person. He choked that old lady. He can't be a good person. You cannot be a good person if you almost force choke an old lady. No, I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. Killmonger's bad.
Like,
even if he's right,
you can make an accurate assessment of history and still have that inform terrible yep. future decisions.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, the museum scene was great. Other than that, he was not a good person.
I do think it's interesting though when you place figures in these positions who are saying things that ostensibly sound correct, right? They're morally correct positions, but yet then do things that are bad, tend to put people in a really uncomfortable position of having to balance those two things out, because on the one hand he's right, but then also he's doing horrible things. So how do you talk about the rightness
yeah.
without accidentally saying okay to the bad?
Yeah, I think it is complex, and we saw that with Killmonger, right?
Yeah.
People, that caused a great debate, and everybody knows where I stand on that. But you know, but I think that is something that you often comes also from looking at anti-colonial movements, and especially looking at the post-colonial. There were so many anti-colonial movements where the heroes of those movements maybe turned out not to be so great afterwards, right? Or the dreams that so many of these movements had, like in much of the continent of Africa, you had so many people who had these lofty dreams of what would come, right? And it happened elsewhere, not just Africa, but elsewhere. But sometimes those who were leading these movements in that moment did not turn out to be best for everyone later on. And sometimes some things turn into nightmares, right? By people who knew how to exploit that type of language. And we see this throughout the world. And so it's always that balance for those who are looking for those changes and to make those changes to be certain, you know, they do not fall for those who would exploit their anxieties to their own ends.
Yeah, there's an element of your book that you're exploring the fact that people need to remain vigilant and have their critical faculties on so that you don't become susceptible to arguments that can lead you to doing really horrible things in the service of good ideas.
Yeah.
Another thing that I guess I kind of want to touch on, we kind of spoke about it earlier, in a sense, about like the tendencies of steampunk as a genre and like some of the attachments that it has. And very obviously, like, as we would have mentioned, placing that kind of story in Egypt kind of ultimately radicalizes it in a way where just that lens alters the way that you think about some of its trappings. And I'm kind of curious, like, what do you think about that kind of duty the story has to the genre as a whole, in that sense of trying to help readers who are already fans of that genre or already fans of that genre space think more critically, not just about the story that they're reading, but about some of the assumptions that they make about space as they read?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know if it was a responsibility, because I kind of feel like this is intuitively the story I want to tell. Like, I could not imagine approaching steampunk with just top hats living in London and, you know, and not talking about what's happening with the underclass of London, what's happening, what is London doing in India, right? What is the British Empire doing in India? How are those Caribbean colonies that slavery just ended, how are those going? Or, you know, what of the various people of color who live here? And I just couldn't, you know, about issues of women's rights and other things, I just couldn't see talking about that and simply, you know, having fun, you know, doing that without touching on those things. And so to me, if I'm telling this story, I think I'm automatically geared towards those things. I think you're correct in a sense. I think setting it in Egypt, doing all these things automatically radicalizes it, because you're automatically moving away from what people think of as the norm, you know, and there's always been this trope, like that this notion, like, well, you don't want to follow old tropes because people have done it before, or, you know, I've heard people, steampunk is dead. Well, no, I haven't had my chance at it. Right. You haven't seen Fatma. You haven't seen a hero here named Fatma, who's wearing a bowler and everything. But she's, you know, a woman from Southern Egypt who is in this ministry. Let me have my chance, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's time to declare it dead, because, you know, it does have problems, but doesn't mean I can't do something with it. I guess I wanted to show that there's still all these stories to tell, and there are probably all these voices who want to tell these kinds of stories. Like, let them do so. You know, because I often hear too often people will say, like, well, this genre has been done to death. We've done too many portal fantasies. I don't want any more princess stories or so. But hey, we all haven't had a chance to do those yet, yeah. Right? Only with a small subset of people. Let me do it. You never know what I might do with the princess story, right? I'm thinking about people who are doing great subversions of those things, who are bringing in new faces and new identities into this. Because when you do, you automatically have to think about all of these things, right? Fatma can't be Sherlock Holmes. Right. She can't be because of who she is and the body that she's in and the world in which she has to navigate. And so that alone is going to change how we would think of this story if it was Holmes doing it. Right. The Sherlock Holmes, if it was who played him? Iron Man. I can't think of his name.
Oh, Robert Downey Jr.
It was Robert Downey Jr. doing this. Right. That's not a thing. She's not the person who's like, I know everything and I can tell where you went to school and how many children you're going to have by the donut you ate for breakfast, right? That's not her. That's not her thing. She, you know, and so I think we do tell these new and different stories simply by, at times, bringing in new characters and new settings. And so I think that's always vastly important.
A part of what you were saying, too, made me think as a reader of how exciting it is if somebody is like, I'm doing a steampunk story, but in a place where this has not been done before. Because there's an element of steampunk is already, right? It is an alternate history, an imagining of a different train of technology, as it were. But what does that look like in the Congo or, you know, India or Bhutan or like wherever, right? There are all these other places that could have had a steampunk movement that just happened not to, but that changes the politics, the types of people involved, right? Your culture, like, it's not like you just get the steam engine and everybody just becomes like England. Like, no, it becomes drastically different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody starts wearing a top hat. Yeah, it's not Star Trek. I love Trek, but you know, Trek has this notion that every society is going to just do this certain version, and then there'll be a point at which they're all wearing unisuits. Everyone's wearing unisuits. The ultimate, that's where it's going to go. is like, you know, I remember they would go visit worlds, and they're like, they're going through their Renaissance period, and they all look like, oh, some Western European Renaissance. It's like, no. Yeah, you're right. People are going to interpret these things differently, and they're going to have different understandings. And in this case, because we're situating this in our world during this time, we're subverting entire power dynamics, right? Yeah. Which itself is monumentally important. I think of the artist Kehinde Wiley, who does this often, right? By taking figures that you would not expect to see, this figure who you would normally associate standing on a corner in Brooklyn, 1990s Brooklyn, not modern gentrified Brooklyn, but 1990s Brooklyn, you wouldn't think of him, you know, on a horse crossing the Alps, where you've superimposed him instead of Napoleon, right? Or mm-hmm. think of him in this knightly gear or something. You just wouldn't think of that. And so I love this idea of how these things subvert power dynamics and what happens when we put these new identities, these new faces, these new people in these new settings. You're right. You know, Sean, how does it subvert and change everything and force us to stand up and say, oh, okay, this is something different.
Yeah, and that's where different subgenres can go. Like, so many of what we think of as the subgenres of science fiction and fantasy have been heavily westernized because that was where a lot of it was being published. And so I think of, like, cyberpunk. Well, okay, but tell me cyberpunk from Shanghai.
How do you not?
Yeah, how do you not? I mean, have you seen Hong Kong?
How do you not? It's just amazing to me, yeah.
And I mean, let's not forget that there are people who have tried to tell those stories when those stories are about exotifying those spaces and those cultures instead of attempting to understand them on their own perspective.
And that's always, you know, I think as outsiders, that's always a challenge to make certain that you try to tell these stories with that type of empathy, rather than looking like, you know, the latest Western explorer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your story doesn't look like a Fodor's manual.
Oh, God.
Lonely Planet.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, really what this is a call to action. All those people around the globe who've ever wanted to write steampunk, but in the place where they were born that has never been done before, do it.
And likely you are doing it. So this is also a call to action to all those publishers and editors. When you see those stories, take a look at them.
Mm-hmm.
If you pass it up because you're like, I'm not certain I understand this. No, take another look, because they're doing it. They've been doing it. Some of them just need the exposure.
Well, okay, can I ask a silly question? Because I think we're getting close to time, and I just got to know. So there's this scene in the book in which a character steams themselves with tea. And I have got to know, first, where can I do that? Because I will do that immediately. And second, is that like a real thing? Do people do that?
You know, what I was actually driving at there, I'm glad you caught that. I know how people caught that. All my little quirks and my little nods to certain things. So that was actually my nod to health movements of that time, right? These movements where there were certain ways that, you know, you could do things to the body and what have you. I think people probably know of Kellogg and all these notions of some strange, you know, that people would go to these go to these places and come up with this. And so this was my ode to it, where this person happens to be very wealthy. And one of the things is to take like this type of, not a regular steam bath, but something a little different with a whole contraption, but it's tea. Right? And, you know, people are like, you know, you smell like tea, right? Afterwards, it's like, yeah, so. And so, but it sounds interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So when I had locks, before I cut all this off and I had locks, I actually had someone who would wash my locks with a herbal tea rinse, and it was great. And I think that's partly where this idea came from. I mean, it was great. I don't know if it actually did anything, but it felt great. I had tea in my hair for a shampoo. And so I think I thought it would be interesting to throw that in there to show that, you know, that part of this is, it is this era where they're creating all of these new gadgets and things, and people are trying them out. And like anywhere, some gadgets are going to make it and some are going to fall by the wayside. Some are going to only be used by a few people and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
I would love to know if that actually worked for him. I highly doubt it did.
Look, don't take my dreams away from me, because if I can do a sauna with tea,
steamed in tea. Yeah, I'm sure.
Gosh. I don't know, because tea is kind of wild, and so maybe, like, you'll just end up, like, a dark copper color with, like, lines from where you know your body, and so you just look like you got the worst tan.
Depends on the tea you use, right? Depends on the tea.
You could be green if it's green.
Oh, God.
I just imagine all these, like, white British people, like, I had a tea bath and they're just bright green.
Yeah.
It's just like people on the corner just snickering like, we know that didn't work, but we're going to keep fooling them.
Thanks for your money.
So, one of the questions I definitely want to ask, a question that I ask every time I meet you, Fenderson, is,
yeah,
what's next? What do we have to look forward? What do we need to look forward to in the future? I'm going to buy a bookshelf dedicated just to you. What's the next one?
And so I have a short story that's coming out in an anthology by Kwame Mbilia called Black Boy Joy. That's probably going to be the next thing that people see, a short story. It's about a young boy who moves from Trinidad to New York, and he's trying his best to adapt to this new life, but a jab has followed him there, and he is causing problems. And so it's called Percival and the Jab.
Okay.
And so I think that comes out is sometime in June.
I'm already very hype. All you needed to do was tell me that.
I think you would like that one, Brandon.
All you needed to tell me was a Trini teenager emigrates. I would have already been hype. Everything about this sounds really, really, really intriguing.
So yeah. So that'll be my next short story. And as far as what I'm working on, I am putting up the final edits on a story that's taken me way too long to write, but it is a story about an undead assassin in a completely secondary fantasy world. So I'm moving away from the alternate world to complete secondary fantasy world with who is given an impossible job.
I see.
That's exciting. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see you going into some different directions with it. So that should be fun.
This is it's really interesting because I think fantasy is probably my first love when it comes to reading, at least what I grew up on. I grew up on a ton of fantasy. I don't know how many times I've reread Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, reread books in Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time. And so, you know, secondary fantasy was where I kind of cut my teeth in publishing some stuff in People of Color Destroys Fantasy or Beneath Ceaseless Skies, which I love to listen to. And I think this is why I probably add magic and fantasy to my steampunk. I can't. It's like, I'm already here. So, I'm already in the fantastic. We've already got airships doing things that defy gravity. So why can't I have my magic too? And so, you know, it's interesting to go to a fully fledged secondary fantasy world because there's something about doing an alternate world. You have to pay attention to the history, but you have the landscape there. It's all there. Egypt is where Egypt is. Cairo is where Cairo is. The secondary world, you're like, oh, what does the map look like? How do they trade? What do they eat? You know, what's their languages? How do I get, what names do I use? You know, names are hard to come up with. So,
yeah, depending on how secondary you really go.
Right, exactly. So when I'm trying to do a complete secondary world, it's been a fun challenge, but putting the finishing touches on it.
Well, I'll help you with names because everyone knows that the most correct way to create names that sound nothing like anything on Earth is just to put apostrophes.
Oh, no.
Oh, don't do
no,
that.
No, no, no,
stop.
No, no,
no, stop.
Nope.
More deep. Do the more deep, and but I get a lot of that from Robert Jordan, right? He throws in his good share of glottal stops.
Uh huh. And I will just idly ask a follow-up to that what's next question, which is there any update about a certain TV thing, about a certain other piece of fiction that you have written in the world, maybe?
Your guess is as good as mine. That world moves very slow. That world, you're never certain where it's going to go and if it's final until it's final. And so, you know, it's like you see all these. I realize there's so much of that world where they make announcements, and part of the announcements is to entice other people by saying, I have this name. And that means I'm trying to entice people in that world who hold the keys. Wouldn't you like to take a chance on this? And so, you know, I would say that it is probably much further ahead than I would have expected, but I can't give anything for certain. But I am hoping, crossing my fingers as much as anyone else.
Well, we are too, because I think you know how much I love that book. And so I think when we did the interview with you, I think I might have mentioned that this just needs to be a TV show immediately. And then
yeah, I think I knew the time and I was like, mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Did you already know it then? Did you already know?
Couldn't say a word, yeah.
That's just great.
But you know, it's in the hands of some some great folks who had, you know, like, I think one of the last things they'd done, at least people remember on TV, was, you know, this is the same folks who produced The Old Guard. So, you know,
I didn't realize it was The Old Guard people. Oh, okay, so I feel cautiously hopeful.
Yeah, that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
So, makes me feel a little confident, but we'll see.
But congratulations either way, because that's obviously really awesome to get that piece of news.
So. Yeah. Just that book still continues to amaze me how much people like it. So it's great. That book was simply supposed to be the filler to get to this novel.
If that was the filler, you write a very astounding filler, and you should do it more often.
It really was. I was like, I gotta get something to fill the gap, because it'll be a while between Haunting of Tramcar 015 and Master of Jin. Gotta get something out there to keep my name in it.
And you did that. You did Ring Shout. Wow. Okay. Gosh, nice. That's amazing.
Sometimes you're lucky, and that was just luck. Because I had no idea what that story was going to do, but I'm eternally thankful and grateful for everyone who's loved it. Yeah.
Well, we're among mm-hmm. them because it's so good.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think I own it on every medium. I have like all your stuff now on any medium it's in that you can buy it in now.
Oh, great. And Master of Jin, by the way, if anyone would like to buy the book and read along to the audio is fantastic.
It's really good. I also got audio the audio.
Done by the same narrator who did Dead Jinn in Cairo, and it's just really fantastic.
I just found out that the audiobook was already out today, so I'm definitely getting that as soon as possible.
And also tell anybody, if you've read the arc, the book has slight differences, the final book. And I always tell this, like, I think everybody should know this, is like the secret. Arcs are always like, they send them out, and there's always still like, it's not the final. And sure enough, do you have changes? No. Okay, I have 4 pages. And so arcs are always, and so somebody had said that, they said I was reading the arc and listening to the audio, which is the final. And I was like, wait a minute, that sentence is not in here. What happened?
Well, Fenderson, thank you so much for coming on again to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is great again. You have a standing, like, you're allowed on this show basically whenever you want. I just let you know, because it's a delight to talk to you.
Yeah, definitely. One of these days we're just going to harass you about history stuff.
Okay, great. We'll just have a history talk, yeah.
Well, if you'd be so kind, would you let folks know where to find you and your work?
Sure. You can find stuff that I write at my website, www.pjellyclark.com, so easy enough to find. You can also read my ramblings at my blog, which you can link through there, called The Disgruntled Harajim.
You're also on Twitter.
I'm also on Twitter at pjellyclark.
Yeah. Well, all right, folks, that's it for today. We've done it. We've done another episode. So as always, if you'd like to suggest, you know, topics, or have any kind of question or comment you want to let us know, skiffingfanty.com/listener suggestions for those shenanigans. Obviously, Skiffy and Fanty on Twitter and Instagram. Subscribe to the newsletter at skiffyandfanty.com/newsletter. We're also working on those 50 iTunes reviews, so you can go do that, and it'll make us cry inside, which is always helpful and useful. And if you want to support the show, patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. We have plans. They are afoot, but they are secret right now, so I can't say anything. As for me, you can find me at Sean Duke or seanduke.net. Or also on patreon.com at The Joy Factory.
You can find me at The Rising Tithes on Twitter, brandonobrien.space, and GMing The Case of the Cinded Seal at speculatesf.com.
Perfect. And now that we are at the end of this, I just want everybody to know that while I don't own a sauna, I am going to go fill my bathtub with tea, and I am going to steam myself in tea right now.
I hope that goes well for you. As for this episode, this is Skiffy and Fanty signing off.
Awkward ending and scene. If you want to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty or skiffyandfanty.com, our website, where you can get access to all of our fancy things. Our music comes from Holy Mole. You can support him and his work at patreon.com/holymole. Thank you for listening.